Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. It was an end and a beginning. The lost great march of the civil rights movement and the birth of black power. In popular memory, the Meredith March won resonance for the rise of Stokely Carmichael, the evolution of Martin Luther King, the bizarre crusade of James Meredith, the alienation of Lyndon Johnson, and the rage of black militants. So writes Aram Gudzusian in Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. This is the new book from the chair of the History Department at University of Memphis and the author previously of King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution, and Sidney Poitier, Man, Actor, Icon. Gudzusian will be giving a public lecture about the book on February 13th at 6 p.m. in Blount Auditorium at Rhodes College, part of Rhodes' community partnership with the Pink Palace connected to their new exhibit on race. Aram, it's great to have you on Counterpoint to talk about Down to the Crossroads.
Jonathan, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Aram, your book does such a wonderful job of reconstructing the Meredith March Against Fear in June 1966, showing how it really was a crossroads in the civil rights movement. Before we get into the details, remind us about how this march from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi came about. What happened? Why was this such a transformative moment in American history?
It's a really extraordinary story. It takes place over 3 weeks in June of 1966, and it starts with really the singular crusade of one man, a man named James Meredith, who was famous for 4 years earlier integrating the University of Mississippi. And of course, this led to the big crisis at Ole Miss. There was violence and ultimately the intervention of the federal government and strong resistance of Mississippi whites. And ultimately, James Meredith spent the year at Ole Miss and graduated. So he was already sort of a civil rights icon, but he was a man who very much resisted being a civil rights icon. He disappeared from the public scene for a while. When he came back in June of 1966, he decided to launch what he called a walk against fear. He was going to walk by himself from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi, about 220 miles down Highway 51. And he was going to do so for two aims, as he put it. One was to encourage voter registration in Mississippi among African Americans. And the second was to conquer what he called a culture of fear. If he, James Meredith, probably the most hated black man in Mississippi, could walk down a highway in Mississippi, it would encourage other African Americans to sort of challenge this culture of fear that existed in Mississippi based on racial terror. But what happened on the second day of his march was he was just outside of Fernando, Mississippi. He was shot. And he survived. But after he was shot, what had been sort of an odd crusade of one man turned into a civil rights extravaganza. Over the next 3 weeks, we would see all the leaders of the major civil rights organizations, marches from across the country, media from around the world descend upon Mississippi for what became a long march of 3 weeks that ultimately detoured into the Mississippi Delta and finished in Jackson, Mississippi 3 weeks later, after just as James Meredith had intended. But it turned into an entirely different event from how it had begun. So it's a three-week capsule that in a lot of ways shows many of the tensions that were going on in the civil rights movement at this time.
And that's one of the things I really love about the book is you take this small incident and you magnify it and you show how many different kinds of issues there are that really were involved, how things were changing, not only in the civil rights movement, but obviously in America as a whole. And we're going to get into that in much more detail. You know, you open the book with this scene from a conference that was organized in Washington, D.C. at the beginning of June 1966 under the direction of Lyndon Johnson's White House called To Fulfill These Rights. And you use that conference as a way to introduce us to the major actors in the civil rights movement and also to give us a sense of the state of the movement in 1966. So where was civil rights in 1966? Who were some of the key actors? What were some of the key institutions that had brought civil rights to this point a decade on, let's say, from Brown versus Board?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Let's start with your first question about where was the civil rights movement at this time? Remember, this is 1966. We've already seen two major pieces of civil rights legislation passed in the previous 2 years. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, which basically would ultimately lead to the desegregation of Southern institutions. And then the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was, of course, designed to encourage voter registration and to put federal protection in place so that more African Americans would vote. These two pieces of legislation ultimately are going to help to transform the South away from Jim Crow. But in June of 1966, from the perspective of many civil rights advocates, nothing has really changed. You know, they don't see voter registration rates skyrocketing yet. They don't see desegregation taking place in any rapid form. And moreover, they see sort of structural issues in place that are sort of the more long, tangled history of racism in America, particularly in the South at this time. So that's sort of where the civil rights movement stands. Remember, we've seen sort of a generation of activists. Martin Luther King has been on the scene for roughly a decade at this time, since the Montgomery bus boycott. and SNCC, which was a student group that was birthed out of the 1960 student sit-ins, is rising in both in prominence but also fracturing around this time. So you've got this whole stew of political back and forth going on within the movement. In some ways, it has achieved great successes. In other ways, it is fracturing. And then the march will ultimately magnify this. You also asked about sort of the major characters. And it's interesting that you asked me about this prologue that I wrote, because I mean, when I wrote the first draft, I didn't include it. And I was wondering if it was appropriate to start with James Meredith walking at first. But then I added it at the end because I thought it was important to set up these major characters and these tensions to sort of paint a picture of where the civil rights movement stood. So this conference that was put on by the White House was just 4 days before the march began. It brought, for instance, Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, and Whitney Young, the head of the Urban League, who were sort of establishment black politics at that time.
So let me just stop you with that and ask you to say a little bit more about some of the differences between these groups, because you've already introduced us to some of the characters. So Martin Luther King, he's head of the SCLC. Tell us a little bit more about their view of civil rights, their approach to dealing with Jim Crow, how they sought to dismantle it. Then tell us a little bit more about the NAACP and about SNCC and about the Urban League.
So King is really sort of in the political center of the civil rights movement in a lot of ways, because, of course, King is the major proponent and architect of nonviolent direct action, and he has used that to sort of stir the moral conscience of the nation, to turn civil rights into a major national story, and to help stimulate public opinion to help lead to the transformative legislation that I talked about before. On the more sort of traditional liberal side of him, you've got the NAACP and you have the Urban League, which are more interested in passing more civil rights legislation, in maintaining a positive relationship with the federal government, trying to create jobs for the masses of African Americans. And then on the other side of King, you've got a swelling black militancy. You see it in a group called CORE, which had begun as a pacifist interracial group and is increasingly becoming an all-black group, which is focused particularly on urban politics and particularly in the North. And then you've got SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, led by a new leader, Stokely Carmichael, which is really pushing in new directions to emphasize black pride, black unity, to stop working within the establishment because the establishment is going too slow. That will create a cycle of compromise, and it won't lead to any substantial gain.
And it's at this conference to fulfill these rights that James Meredith announces this March Against Fear, as it comes to be called, through Mississippi. You've told us a little bit about Meredith, that he's the young man who integrated Old Miss. Paint a fuller picture for us of Meredith. Tell us his story. Where did he come from? What was his background? How did he end up becoming the person who integrates Old Miss? What happened in the course of that conflict? And then you said he went away for a few years. Where did he go, and how does he reemerge on the scene?
In many ways, Meredith is the most fascinating character in the book, in my opinion, because he doesn't fit into any sort of ideological or political box. He was raised in rural Mississippi. He comes from a family that prides itself on its independence. His father owns land and is a registered voter at a time when very few African Americans in Mississippi do so. And he instills that sense of almost a conservative self-reliance in Meredith, sort of this focus on the unindividual sort of classic conservatism. And Meredith sort of embraces those values very much. He sees himself as set apart, as special, as an elite in a lot of ways within the black community, but more generally. He has a very strong sense of himself. He serves in the military. He's older than your typical college student. He's in his late 20s when he integrates Ole Miss, but he's in his early 30s by the time of the march. After his year at Ole Miss, he's sort of searching for his place. He sees himself as having gone through this great experience. It's tested him. In many ways, it has isolated him even more because it's put enormous pressure on him. You know, when he decided to integrate Ole Miss, he applied himself. Only later did he go to the NAACP for legal help, but it was an initiative that he had started himself. He saw it as his fundamental right. So he's very much a self-driven man. When he gets out of Ole Miss, he, in a lot of ways, alienates others in the civil rights movement. He doesn't really want to work within an organization. Sometimes he insults the contributions of other civil rights leaders. He's a very much a critic of nonviolence. And part of this is his military background. He served in the Air Force for 10 years. He doesn't believe that nonviolence is an effective tactic for gaining respect. He travels to Africa for a while on a fellowship, but he abandons that. He's in Columbia Law School at the time when he begins his march. And he has political ambition. Part of the reason that he decides to come back to Mississippi to lead this march is he thinks that it can stimulate a political career if he moves back to Mississippi. With the passage of the Voting Rights Act, with increased voter registration, he doesn't just see it as this is something that he's doing for the public good. His vision for this walk when he starts it is as he walks down Highway 51 in Mississippi, he'll encourage people to register, he'll meet local leaders, and he'll build a political following. So the idea is that by the time he gets to Jackson, he's built up a substantial group around him who will become his political supporters when he does decide to run for political office.
In addition to voter registration, you said he wanted to break the culture of fear in Mississippi. Tell us a little bit more about What structured that culture of fear? What was African American life like in the Mississippi? What was it like for blacks living there in 1966?
In many ways, Mississippi takes sort of the worst aspects of Jim Crow, of segregation, and magnifies them. It is the state with the lowest rates of voter registration, is the state with the highest rates of racially motivated violence. When civil rights activists start organizing in Mississippi in the early 1960s, the spate of arsons and attacks and shooting into their homes is consistent. The numbers on it are staggering. Mississippi has this legacy that even for civil rights activists, that it's almost like a world set apart in terms of how violent the resistance is against fighting for racial equality. I tell some of these stories in the book of things that occur in June of 1966. This is still a state where there is a strong sense of white supremacist groups that will use violence against civil rights activists. There's the murder of an innocent man in southwest Mississippi during the march, a poor man named Ben Chester White, who was murdered by three people who were affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan, with the idea that it would bring media attention to this town just outside of Natchez, Mississippi. And in doing so, it would bring Martin Luther King off the march to there. Then they would try to assassinate Martin Luther King as well. This is just one example of a story of the kind of politics that could still exist in Mississippi. Does that mean that everyone in Mississippi was part of the Ku Klux Klan? No. But if the Klan is still an active organization, if this type of political far-right extremism is still out there, then that means that puts people, the majority of white Mississippians who are still support segregation, who would still see civil rights as a communist-themed conspiracy, in the political center in Mississippi. So that gives you just some sense of the political climate in 1966 at this time.
Post-Civil War, you've got sharecropping, but that's also beginning to dry up as the Cotton Belt itself changes. Can you tell us a little bit more about employment opportunities for blacks in Jim Crow, Mississippi?
So there's sort of an irony going on in terms of the economic life of African Americans, particularly in the Mississippi Delta. The march detours into the Mississippi Delta region, which is along the western edge of Mississippi, particularly between Memphis and between Jackson. Historically, as you mentioned, it is a region of sharecropping. It is a region where African Americans were exploited for their labor. But what's happening by the 1960s, especially by the mid-1960s, is that these large plantations that have relied really on field hands for so long for their work are becoming mechanized. And they're using more pesticides and herbicides. So the need for African American labor is actually dwindling. So the people who get left on these plantations tend to be the old and the very young and the sickly. And there's very little work for those who are able-bodied, who would be willing to work for $3 a day, but can't even find that work.
So we're just talking about dire poverty, horrific conditions in terms of access to education. As you've already suggested, it's really sort of the worst side of where the situation for blacks has left them by 1966. You already mentioned in previewing what happens on the march as a whole that on the second day of the march, the second day, Meredith is shot. What happened? What was the response of civil rights leaders once that happens? Because as you said, he leaves basically alone. He's got three other people who begin the march with him, but it soon becomes this large spectacle.
As you mentioned, it's the second day of the march. He's just passed through Hernando, Mississippi, which is the first town in Mississippi after you cross the state line on Route 51, just a few miles south of the town. Remember, he's surrounded by law enforcement officials, the press, and a few people who have decided to walk with him from the first day. But it's a hilly road, and he's coming over a crest, so there's some cars ahead of him, some cars behind him, and a man jumps out from the side of the road and shoots three times, saying, "James Meredith, I only want James Meredith." So other people clear away, and Meredith's trying to run away, but Meredith gets shot three times. And as I mentioned before, of course, he survives the attack, but he is wounded. And this becomes one of the interesting mysteries of the march. The man who shoots him, a man named Aubrey James Norville, had no connection to any white supremacist organization, had no apparent motivation for shooting James Meredith. And he was here in Memphis. He lived in a subdivision in what's now Bartlett. And so it was a great mystery as to why he decided to shoot him. And this is a mystery that still remains unsolved. Norville will spend a couple of years in prison in Parchment Penitentiary in Mississippi after this, but he's never revealed his motive, and it's never been clear exactly why he shot him. So that launches this whole set of conspiracy theories. For many civil rights activists, they think, oh, the Mississippi police were in on this. They let this guy shoot him. The FBI maybe even let this happen. You know, some civil rights activists are thinking that's the case because they didn't protect Meredith when this guy jumped out from the side of the road and shot him. What's interesting also is that many white Southerners think this is a conspiracy against white people, that the civil rights movement paid this guy to shoot James Meredith so that it would launch this big civil rights extravaganza. And part of their argument was that he didn't shoot him to kill him. He was shooting him with birdshot, which just sort of sprays shots, right, and tends to wound you unless you're shooting from very close. Why did Norville do it? I don't know. I never cracked that mystery. And others have tried as well. But it does create this fascinating political dynamic in which each side is accusing the other of these conspiracies. The other thing that it does, of course, is this is front page news in every newspaper in America. There's a famous picture of James Meredith writhing on the side of the road. It's a picture that later wins a Pulitzer Prize in photography. It is on the front page of every major newspaper in America, and it is published internationally, right? This is a story throughout the world. So what had been getting sort of minor media coverage, all of a sudden it launches into a huge national to-do. And it leads to all these civil rights organizations, which hadn't been working in concert much over the course of the past year. They had been starting to ideologically drift more and more apart. But they all sort of want a piece of this march, and they see it as important to carry on Meredith's march. And they all see a political opportunity, but they see different political opportunities. For Roy Wilkins and the NAACP, they see this as a lobbying tool to help pass another civil rights bill. For Martin Luther King, he sees this as a way to not only pass that civil rights bill, but also to launch a broader conversation about some of the issues you were discussing, Jonathan, about poverty, about sort of the structural inequities that exist, so that the nation can begin a larger conversation about the intertwining of class and race. And for groups like SNCC, for people like Snokely Carmichael, the new chairman of SNCC, they see this as a way to advertise a new direction in black politics, what becomes ultimately the famous slogan of black power.
And they all converge and become involved in the march, and this, of course, elevates the profile of the march. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to Aram Gudzouzian about his new book, Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. Now, as the march begins to gather momentum, it becomes a front-page story now on newspapers nationally and internationally. Tell us more about what the response of whites like Governor Paul Johnson was. How was it reported in local newspapers? How did white Mississippians react in general?
Paul Johnson has been the governor since winning election in 1964, and he replaced Ross Barnett, who was an arch segregationist. It was Barnett who created, ultimately, the Ole Miss crisis that had led to the great violence on the Ole Miss campus in 1962. Johnson paints himself much more as sort of a man of progress, not a man who's going to resist federal law, but certainly a supporter of segregation at the same time. Once the march begins, basically what Johnson wants is for there to be a minimum of conflict. He sort of learned the lesson that many Southern whites had learned is that when there's violence, that helps the civil rights movement, right? Because then it leads to all this moral outrage and it leads to sort of a stirring, swelling political opinion. So you saw that, for instance, in Birmingham in 1963 when attack dogs are being sicced on women and children. That raises sympathy for the civil rights movement. You saw it with the Freedom Rides in 1961 when if you're bombing a bus, well, that's going to sort of lead to more public opinion sympathizing with the civil rights movement. So basically what he wants is for this march to be protected well, to have a minimum of conflict. If they're going to register voters as they go along, that's fine. Just do it and keep moving. And he tries to use the state highway patrol to work with local law enforcement to keep things moving as quickly as possible and to keep a minimum of conflict. At least that's his stated policy at the beginning. The more general political opinion among white Southerners, and remember that in Mississippi, it's unfair to blanket every white Mississippian with the same brush, but by the same token, you don't see any outspoken support of a civil rights march going on through the heart of Mississippi in June of 1966. There are those who say, let it pass through, let it go with a minimum of violence, and there are others who say this is a communist conspiracy and this is an outrage, and they talk about all these various conspiracy theories, and they paint Martin Luther King as this extremist outsider. And they're constantly talking about, well, look at the problems of race that exist throughout the nation, and you're unfairly picking on Mississippi. They also say, hey, the guy who shot Meredith, he wasn't from Mississippi. He was from Memphis. So this must be, this is another outsider coming into and giving Mississippians a bad name. So there's this whole larger political conversation going on. There's very little, again, open support for the march among whites, but the range of political opinion goes from everything from the sort of tactical, let's let this march pass through and it's a temporary insult that we can stomach, to let's resist this however we can. One sort of example of that is that constantly along the march, they're being heckled. People are waving Confederate flags at the marchers and using them as a symbol of resistance against civil rights. That's a pretty constant theme throughout the march.
What about nationally? What was going on in terms of the response of the federal government? How did Lyndon Johnson react to this, since he's the one who had carried through these prior civil rights legislation?
As you mentioned, of course, Lyndon Johnson was a legislative master, right? Without his political skill, it's tough to imagine the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or the Voting Rights Act of 1965 getting through as it did in that form at that time. But what's interesting, what's happened to Johnson by 1966 is in many ways he's grown alienated from the civil rights movement. He's a man who demands loyalty. The way that he saw the civil rights movement developing at first, he saw it as an affirmation of his own leadership. that he in some way saw himself as the leader of the civil rights movement with the passage of this legislation. And what's happened in the year since the passage of the Voting Rights Act is he's seen a surge in urban violence. The Watts riot in Los Angeles from the summer of 1965 sort of showcased a whole new range of problems that are related to race that are outside the South and are outside these pieces of legislation. He's also seeing black militants, people like Stokely Carmichael and of SNCC and Floyd McKissick of CORE, who are critical of the federal government for not moving fast enough. And he sees this as a breach of his loyalty. In a lot of ways, he's disengaging from the civil rights movement. He is not resisting it, but he doesn't embrace the march. And particularly because as the march continues and as black power becomes a key slogan for the march with which it's associated, and as militants are helping to shape the media's response to the march, he doesn't see any political value in his administration being associated with the march. That leads to trouble toward the end of the march, when that basically gives the state of Mississippi more free rein to handle the marchers as they see fit without any federal intervention.
And the other aspect is, of course, the international backdrop to this is that the United States is involved in the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And even supposedly more moderate leaders like King have begun to speak out against the war. So they're beginning to couple together American militarism, one might even say American imperialism, and poverty locally, and seeing that these two things are intertwined issues. So let's use that as a way of turning now to another one of the really fascinating characters in the story, and that's Stokely Carmichael, because a key aspect of what it is that you narrate in this story is how the slogan Black Power ends up becoming launched during the March Against Fear. So what exactly did Carmichael mean by Black Power? And then if you can just go beyond that, how was it understood at the time? And did the call for Black Power indicate that, in fact, the civil rights movement was over? Or was Black Power really a continuation of the civil rights movement?
Those are really important questions for trying to think about what Black Power means, both within its time and as we've moved forward. Because it is a slogan and a chant that becomes laden with all this symbolic value, but also a great deal of divergent opinions and misunderstandings about what it means. A little background on Carmichael. Here's a man who was raised in New York, went to Howard University, and right from the beginning of his college life was active in the civil rights movement, both in Cambridge, Maryland, but then coming south. His first time in Mississippi was as a freedom rider, and he spent 39 days in jail in Parchman Penitentiary. That was sort of his baptism by fire, if you will. Used nonviolence, but always saw it as a tactic rather than a way of life. He saw it as an effective political tactic, but he didn't see it as something to embrace, unlike King, right? Martin Luther King sees it as a way to create what he called a beloved community. For Carmichael, this was just more simply something that was served a means. And he saw it as ultimately becoming less effective over time, that it had served its purpose by the mid-1960s. He becomes the new chairman of SNCC in 1966, right before the march in May of 66, and he replaces John Lewis, now, of course, the congressman from Georgia. And Lewis was, in many ways, an adherent of King's values. And Lewis, in a lot of ways, had lost touch with sort of the rank and file in SNCC, those who wanted to create more of a organization with an African-American identity, and also one that was going to stop trying to create a positive relationship with the federal government and to more challenge the federal government to the extent that it could. So part of the reason that Carmichael decides that SNCC is going to get involved in this march, because SNCC, by the 66, had decided, you know, we're no longer going to be part of these massive federal demonstrations. They go against what we stand for. We're more about organizing people on a local scale. But he also sees an opportunity here. This is a chance to project the message of Black Power to a larger public. And it's in doing so through Mississippi, where SNCC had done much of its organizing in the early 1960s. We're hitting the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, 1964, this summer. And SNCC was really the great architect of Freedom Summer in a lot of ways. And Carmichael was a master organizer based in Greenwood, Mississippi. 2 years later, June of 66, the march detours to Greenwood, Mississippi. And that is where Carmichael decides to launch this slogan, where they hold a big rally. And he's used advance organizers to prep people for this slogan so that when he says, what do we want, they're going to respond with Black Power. Well, what does Black Power mean, right? It means a lot of things. It grows out of the civil rights movement in a lot of ways. A lot of activists will say Black Power was something we've been working for since we first started organizing, right? Black Power means black people having a stake in society. It means having a black sheriff. It means electing black officials. It means putting black people's political power to use, right? It means black people having a positive sense of themselves, sort of a more cultural meaning to it, right? A sense of pride in who they are, in their history, in their culture, that this isn't something to be denigrated. It isn't something to be considered second class, but rather should be appreciated on its own merits. That's all part of Black Power. So it is very constructive in that regard. Black Power is also a critique, though, of the civil rights movement. In the same way that it is an outgrowth of the civil rights movement, it is a stance against some of its core tenets: nonviolence, and sort of an embrace of liberal politics, of a positive relationship with the federal government. Nonviolence, some of the key tenets of Black Power is that not to launch violent revolution necessarily, that's not how SNCC would have defined it in 1966, but more that if you are attacked, you have the right to attack back, right? You have the right to fight back. You have the right to defend yourself. And in fact, on the march, there's a group called the Deacons for Defense, a group that had started just a few years earlier in Louisiana. This is a group of Black men who are armed, and they patrol alongside the march. When the march sets up its tent for the night as it moves south through Mississippi, they're patrolling the area around it, and they're shooting back against night riders and against people who might want to wreak havoc with the marchers. So they see this as part of their core tenet, a critique of nonviolence and a critique of sort of liberal politics. So there's a lot of frustrations that are brewing within Black Power as well, the slow pace of these federal reforms. They don't care about more civil rights laws being passed. They enforce the ones that you have on the books, right? We don't need more laws. We need actual change on the ground. And a lot of that comes from their experience as sort of on-the-ground organizers. They put themselves into communities. They know lots of local people. They know about the concerns of locals. Their job isn't to become leaders themselves. They want to build local people into leaders. So they see Black Power as part of that.
So it was about Black pride. It was about economic empowerment. It was about political empowerment. It was about the right to self-defense. But again, one of the things you show is that, in fact, the way it was read in the media was oftentimes that Black Power was about militancy. It was about insurgency. It was about overturning things. And in fact, one of the most interesting things you show is that immediately there begin charges that Black Power is a form of reverse racism. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting to see. There's so many interesting things in the book. One of the artful things that I think you do is sort of put Dr. Martin Luther King a little bit more in the background in order to highlight the role of people like Stokely Carmichael or other civil rights actors. And I think this is really a virtue of the book, given the way in which King has become such an icon of the movement. But at the same time, part of what we see through the course of the book is a much more nuanced and deeper portrait of Martin Luther King in the Meredith March. Tell us a little bit more about what King's contribution to the March Against Fear was, but also about how the story of the March Against Fear can refine our understanding of Dr. King.
I think that the march reveals King at his finest in many ways. It also reveals him in sort of a tragic light, in the sense that the march at times leaves him in very deep despair, that he realizes in a lot of ways his vision for a beloved community seems to be falling apart. His unity with other civil rights workers seems to be fracturing. At one point, at maybe his lowest point, just a few days before the end of the march, he refers to the whole march as a terrible mistake. But at the same time, I have to say that I came away from researching and writing the book with an enriched respect for Martin Luther King. And that's not something that I would have expected. And I thought I was going to be highlighting a lot more local stories and as you mentioned, all the people around King. But I think King is the moral center of the march, and he's trying to balance so many different things going on at the same time. When he speaks before these crowds, he's still viewed almost as a messiah by local people, that they see him as the special moral character. It's his job often to balance this militant rhetoric, which does use the language of violence, which does use the language of overthrowing, right? Even if it's a rhetorical device by Stokely Carmichael and others, it still is incendiary in a lot of ways, and that's what the media is reading. And it's King who's trying to balance that. It's King who's saying, you know, we can't go get our Molotov cocktails. Look at who we are. We're 10% of the population, and we're not the majority anywhere. We have to be able to work with white people. Black people need white people, and white people need black people if the nation is going to conquer the larger issues of poverty and racism that exist out there. There's so many times in the march where I was struck by how King just had the right words at the right time and had the right way of connecting with people, even as the larger political task was becoming impossible for him to handle. And that wasn't his fault. It was just sort of the larger political climate that was out there.
Aram Gadzouzian, thank you so much for being with us today on Counterpoint, for really showing how one seemingly local story can illuminate an entire moment, a moment not only in the civil rights movement, but an important transitional moment in the history of America.
Thanks so much for having me, Jonathan. I really appreciate it.
Gadzouzian will be giving a public lecture about the book on February 13th at 6 p.m. in Blount Auditorium at Rhodes College, part of Rhodes's community partnership with the Pink Palace, connected to their new exhibit on race. Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.